Oh, yeah. Well, shortly after Pearl Harbor Day, Frank and Tom went into the hospital to be operated on. Tom was having his tonsils out, and Frank had some problem with a deviated septum. Nothing too serious. So after a couple of days, they're all ready to leave, and they go out on leave on the Sunday afternoon. And they're in their dress blues. They have their pass to go. When they hear that a group of professional football players are coming in to visit the men and to ask them to get better quicker in the hospital. So Frank hears about this and he goes up to Tom. He says, listen, these guys are going to come in here in this room. Let's get into the bed, pull the covers over ourselves, and maybe they'll take a picture of us. So Tom says, well, okay. So they get there and football players come in, and one of them is Bruiser Kennard. It's the Brooklyn Dodgers. And he sees the two brothers there. And he goes over and he talks to them. And then as he's leaving, he turns to them, he says, listen, fellas, get well real quickly. So you go out and fight those Japs. So they leave. And with that, Frank pulls off the covers and he takes his pass and he runs out past the football players. And he holds up the pass and he says, hey, Bruiser, how's this for getting well real quick? So now, right shortly after that, he went up into the North Atlantic. He was on a weather ship, and he was the weatherman. And they got caught in the ice floes and so forth, and they couldn't get out. So the captain says to him after a while, listen, Keith, what are we going to do? He says, you'll use all your scientific devices, and we can't get out. Frank says, I think we're going to make a three-day novena. He said, what the hell is a three-day novena? So he tells him, well, he says, it's a Catholic prayer. He says, for 3 days. And he says, you pray, and maybe at the end of 3 days, we'll be able to get out of this mess here. The captain says, well, we tried everything else. Why not go ahead? So he makes a three-day novena. And at the end of 3 days, he tells the pilot, who was on the ship there, to go up and look around and see if they can get out of the ice floe. And the pilot comes out after 45 minutes. He says, I found the way out. So they get out of the ice floe, and the skipper says, Keith, I don't know what this thing is about the three novena, but I'm all for it from now on. That's it.
You told the story about him defending himself.
About what?
He defended himself. He was brought up on some sort of charges for flying on
Well, he was brought up on charges. And Jimmy Smith, one of our neighbors, was the secretary there.
Can we just stop? Mind if you just start off with that?
Yeah, well, he was brought up on charges, and he was going to be caught. He was court-martialed, and he decided that he was going to defend himself rather than have one of the Navy lawyers defend him. So Jimmy Smith is the secretary there, or the yeoman, as they call him in the Navy, and he had to take down all the notes and so forth and so on. And he told us later on, Frank was exonerated. So he said, I said to him after it was over, I said, well, weren't you afraid of maybe being court-martialed? He says, oh, no, I wasn't afraid of that. And he says, I wasn't going to leave my naval career in the hands of some dumb lawyer. So Jimmy Smith told us, he started to talk, and he had the jury there, and they were supposed to say no. He was having them say yes. And if they're supposed to say yes, he was having them say no. So then he had all the testimony read back, and all they could do was let him off.
Because it was so confusing, the testimony.
That's right.
You told one story about that he would come in when he was stationed at shore leave or something. He said he was stationed, and I guess one of his friends in the neighborhood was actually an officer.
Buddy Wideline was he was an aviator, and he was also, they were both assigned to the base in Brooklyn at this time. Buddy had been in the African invasion, and Frank had been in the North Atlantic and so forth, but they happened to draw at the same time. And Buddy was an officer, Frank is an enlisted man. And Buddy would pick him up every night, and he'd drive him to the airport to fly back to the airfield. And Frank, when he'd get out, would say, okay, Bud, pick me up tomorrow at 8 o'clock. And Bud said, geez, you know, there was no problem picking him up, but he said, he didn't use any diplomacy at all. He said, after all, I was an officer. He was an enlisted man. Other people see that, they figure, what the hell's going on here? So he said, I thought I'd get really, I really get onto him. He said, I know what he was doing. He was going to another part of the base. He was pulling out a mat and going to sleep. So he said, this night, one, I had a duty. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, I called him. He said it was cold. And he said, I told him to come over. I wanted to see him. So he came over there and he said, he's all bundled up. And he's got one guy with him who's the lower than he is in the Navy. Kid by the name of Zimley, who was an apprentice seaman. So Buddy said, Keith, I want you to go over across the air base there. And I want you to get me a quart of coffee. And I want it real quick. And he turns around to Zimley. He says, Zimley, you heard the officer. Let's go. And he says, you run down. He said, I was so mad. I picked up an inkwell and threw it at him, but I missed.
Oh, because he was telling Zimley.
He was telling Zimley what to do. He says, Zimley was going to get the coffee.
We were talking a little before about your diaries.
Yeah.
When did you first start doing them?
1941. When I went over, well, no, I really started early in 41. As a matter of fact, one of my entries in February of 1941, I note the fact that the 7th Regiment is New York has been called up for active duty. And they were leaving from downtown New York to get the ferry, I believe it was. And I happened to be down there, and I saw two of my friends, Bill Wren and Bud Arnstein, both on the line getting ready to go. Now, I don't know whether this is true or not, but I think Bud's wife, Rita, told me later on that when they got on the subway up near the base, up near the armory, they had to pay a nickel to get on the subway. I haven't been able to verify that, but that's what she told me.
This is the subway that was going to get them?
Yeah, to take them down. The subway would take them to downtown. They get off downtown, and then they take the ferry over to Weehawken, I think it was, or something like that.
Well, they'd already been signed in.
Oh, yeah. They were. They had their uniforms on.
Right.
None of them fitted. I tell you, they were a sorry group of guys. Plus, the fact that they were called up was a big surprise. That was before we were in the war, you know.
Yeah.
But then a lot of them, of course, became flyers. Bill Wren was a pilot, a fighter pilot. And he is an official ace. He got credited with knocking down 5 German planes. He told me he really felt he got 17 German planes, but he couldn't prove it because, you know, you have to have a witness.
Right.
And he's off by himself somewhere and he had no witnesses. But he felt quite certain he had 17. And Bud Arnstein was a pilot of a B-24, and he was stationed in Italy, and he was knocked down at one time, and he got back okay. And
did you have a sense then when you started the diary that this was going to be an important time, do you think?
I had no sense at all about it, you know, just a little something to do. I really started writing it up, though, when I went to Trinidad in September of 41, and then from there I went to British Guiana, and then on to Brazil, then on to the Yukon. So I have when I met your mother, you know,
yeah.
How we dated and all that sort of stuff. How we'd go into dinner in White Horse and all.
Do you think at that time you had, what was the sense of the other people around you too? It was just this, you're getting out of school, you're looking for jobs, and all of a sudden this war was happening.
Yeah.
So it was just, you didn't know what was going on in a way. You were...
Well, the war was on in Europe for two years before I went to overseas. It was September of 39, they invaded Poland.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very much aware of the war. We were all aware of it because the previous year invaded Poland.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very much aware of the war. We were all aware of it because the previous year in May of and June of 1940, you had the Dunkirk experience with the British and French just being able to get hundreds of thousands of men back to England without any equipment, all of their guns and all of their armory and so forth, and cars, jeeps, they all had to be left behind. So we were aware of what was going on, you know, and a matter of fact, my brother Tom, he was on a destroyer then in the North Atlantic. And I remember saying to him one time that I was 4F, but I was the first member of the family that it would be chased by U-boats. I had been out in the Caribbean about the 20th of December when the U-boats were knocking all of the ships off.
What year?
In 1941, right after Pearl Harbor Day. So Tom started to laugh. He says, listen, I hate to take away the honor from you, he says, but we weren't playing potsy out on the neutrality patrol, which started, you know, in 1940, I think. And the destroyers were out there, and they were dropping depth bombs on the subs even in those days.
So before officially war was declared, our neutrality thing, and that's where FDR was trying to get support going, and you'd think the country would buy it, or at least not wholeheartedly.
Well, I tell you,
he was trying to support the British.
We didn't know. It was we were more interested in what was going on in Europe. And Pearl Harbor came as a complete surprise. I remember I had charge of the motor pool at Trinidad in the base for the engineers. And I was out on a trip that day. It was a Sunday. And I got back to the base that night at 8 o'clock and it was dark. And discipline was lax before we left, you know. And all of a sudden I come in there and I'm stopped with some guy with a bayonet. And he says, let me see your ID card. I said, what the hell do you mean, the ID card? You know, we just ignored it. So he says, let me see the ID card. I saw him. Well, he's got a rifle there. It must be something serious. So I said, let me send it over. So I went back into the barracks. And I said to the guy, what's this crap about some guy wanting my ID card? He says, war with Japan. I said, what? They said, war with Japan. Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. So I went down to the radio shack. I didn't believe it. And then I heard it, of course. And you know how the rumors start. The first thing you know, the rumors going around that the Japs are going to come from Hawaii. They're going to come through the Panama Canal, and then they're going to come another 150 miles, and they're going to knock us off in Trinidad.
Really?
And yeah, that's how they start. Rumors, no matter where you go. And another thing I always noticed when I was overseas, was if you were in a place for 3 days, 4 days, all of a sudden you're a veteran, you know everything about it. And you'd pull into a camp and you'd say to the guys, what about this? And they'd say, this, boom, 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 you know. And they say, how long have you been here? I've been here a week. it was kind of amazing, you know.
Well, there wasn't that much to know, or since they knew a little, it was better.
Well, they knew a little, and you wanted somebody to give you a little faith in what you were doing, you know, because they knew what was going on. And I remember when we went up to Whitehorse, we left New York in a troop transport, a train, and we rode for a couple of days, and we got to Edmonton. And I'm telling you, we were playing in Camp 150 in Edmonton, and it was the greatest chow I ever had in all my life. It was wonderful. I couldn't get over it. I thought, boy, this is really something. But I got my comeuppance. We went from Camp 150 to Prince Edward, which was right out near Prince Rupert on the west coast. And on the train ride there, you had no place to sleep at all, and all they gave you was beans and coffee twice a day. Then we got to Camp Edward, and the food there was pretty good. And I remember there were movies at the time. And when we were in Edmonton, we went to the movies, and there was a song, what the picture was, I don't remember now, but the song was, buckle down, Winsocky, buckle down. You can win Winsocky if you knuckle down. So I thought it was a nice picture. But then they asked me to go when I was in Prince Rupert. And I said, no, I don't care to go. But I knew what the picture was, because when the guys come back, they were singing, buckle down, Winsocky, buckle down. You can win Winsocky if you knuckle down. So then we got up to Skagway, Alaska. And on the way up, again, we were in a ship called the Ann Hennefey, which they used to transport horses in before we got there. And it was really, it stunk by the time we got there.
Like the horses.
Oh, boy, it was something. So anyway, we would have, again, beans and coffee twice a day. So on the way up, we were in the inland waterway, and it was beautiful, the glaciers and all that stuff. And there was one big Irishman from New York, John Flynn. He was 250 pounds on the hoof, and he stood about 6 feet, and he was solid. And we're talking about the construction jobs that we had worked on, and amongst the group, they had been practically all over the world. And John says, pipes up, he says, "Well," he says, "there's the best goddamn contractor of them all." And I said, "Yeah, dumb Irishman, who the hell is that?" He says, "Old man nature, old man nature, the best contractor of them all." And he says, "But it's only right, after all, he has those people working for him." I said, "Who's that?" He says, "All those elements, all those elements." So then we get to Skagway, and he asked me to go to the picture show, and I said, "Nah, I'm a little too tired. I think I'll just read a book." I knew what it was because they come back to "Buckle Down, Wind Soccer, Buckle Down."
Were they bringing the film with them?
Wind
Soccer, ship
to Buckle Down. So anyway, we're in Skagway for about, oh no, on the way up with Skagway, it was raining and we were getting soaked. And they give us our beans and coffee. And there was a, you know, these men were in their 40s and 50s. These are guys who are really patriotic. They were, you know, they were too old for the service, but they wanted to do something to help the war effort. So we're going up there, and it's raining to beat the hell, and some of the guys started to protest. So Captain Brown, he's in charge of the ship, you know, or the contingent. He's not the ship captain, but he represents the army who's bringing us up there. And he said, some of the guys start to protest, and he gets up and he gives a big speech on patriotism. And but in the meanwhile, it's raining and we're getting soaked, and the seagulls are duffing us, you know, and he's underneath the top. He's not getting wet at all. So he keeps going like that, and all of a sudden, guy yells out, "Hey, watch out, Captain Brown, or those seagulls will make you a major." And with that, he just smeared it. He says, "Well, you sons of bitches can go to hell." And they took him, they threw stuff at him and everything. And we feel boring. We really showed the army today. We showed the army. But the army showed us. So we got to Skagway. We get off the ship. And they could have brought the buses right up to the ship. The buses were about a quarter mile away. And this colonel goes up there. He says, "All right, you bastards, stop walking." And we start walking, and it's raining, and we're carrying all our gear. So then the first thing you know, we take the narrow gauge railroad and we go right into Whitehorse. We get into Whitehorse in the morning, and then we got all our gear and so forth and so on. And then we marched into the office where we were going to be assigned. And that's how I met your mother.
And the other day, we talked about that, riding on the narrow gauge.
Oh, yeah.
Railroad, and I said to him, "Oh, I'm glad I didn't make that trip. I never wanted to. How did you stand it?" He said, "It was dark. I couldn't see anything."
Couldn't see anything. I slept through it.
Because it was known to be really slippery.
Oh, yeah, not only that, it was about this wide apart with the wheels on the train. And you just look straight down.
Oh, you mean it was like it's only single narrow gauge seats on either side?
Oh, and it's the big, you know, valleys, deep.
No, they had sides on the train and everything, but I'm saying the windows were down that low, and there was nothing on each side. The track was there, and it dropped, and it was the same both sides.
Were the trains narrow trains, too?
Yeah, and the train could only go one way. There was only one set of tracks.
Oh, so...
So it got there, and then it would turn around and go back. It was
right.
Always on the same track,
I
so
see.
You couldn't meet anybody if you met in trouble. But all these years, I didn't know. You know, why he wasn't that much upset about it. He says, "I couldn't see anything. It was dark."
Because everybody else who had done the trip, when they told you about it, it was... Had
oh,
you done
really
that trip, too?
No. I had no desire to do it.
You could see it. You know, when you went around the road, you could see it. Later on, we saw it. You know.
I could see it and everything. And so it pulled into Whitehorse. Didn't run for many years, but the year that we went
up,
Dee Dee and Wyman, too.
But your mother nearly got killed when she was up there. Tell the story.
What do you know of the story?
Well, just what she told me, you know. She was in a jeep.
We were in a jeep going up the mountain. Two soldiers and Jerry, one of my friends, and I. And Jerry and I were in the back, and the two boys were in the Jeep in the front. And we're like halfway up the mountainside, and the roads were gravel roads, and the mountain is, the side of the mountain's here, and the road is cut into it, and down here is just, you know, way, way down. And Glenn and Wink decided to change, and without stopping the car, change drivers. So one is kind of going over with the other, and the car started backwards down the mountain. How it shifted like that, no idea, but all of a sudden we're going backwards down the mountain.
Oh, we probably put it into neutral.
Probably, I don't know, I never got to that detail. And we're going down the mountain, and Jerry stands up and she's screaming, and Wink and Glenn are still trying to, you know, maneuver so they can get a hold of the wheel, and they're, you know, the wheel. And Jerry's screaming, and I smacked her in the face and said, shut up, and I'm, you know, stare into the side of the mountain. And that's how we were stopped. They steered into the, you know, the side of the mountain. But it was a horrible experience.
But you knew to slap the girl and tell the guy what to do.
Right.
You shut up, you do your job.
We were four scared people after it was over.
When we were talking the other day, we were discussing about the different experiences you had, both educational and your work experience with the hospital, and then in Whitehorse, and then we talked about, was it Life magazine or Look magazine?
Look.
Look. And I was thinking later, the other thing that we didn't talk about was when you decided to go into business with Marie.
With Marie?
Yeah, I don't think we mentioned that at all. Which was,
we hadn't got up that far.
How old were you at the time? How many kids had you had by then?
I don't remember.
Because that was Allen Drive.
When we moved to Seaford, onto Allen Drive, is when I first met Marie.
51.
Right. And I had already been making clothes for
people.
And then
we made the habits for the nuns, too, didn't we?
Right, right. That was when I was in, still in Freeport, I guess. And Nell and John lived next to me.
I thought it was for the, when I was, the nuns in Merrick.
It was Merrick, right, right.
So she must have been in Merrick.
No, I must have been just after we moved to. Because they moved to Merrick first, and then we moved to Freeport. No, we moved to Freeport next to them.
You moved to Seaford first, or they moved to Merrick?
They moved to Merrick first.
Had Marie done that sort of work before?
Marie had, yeah, she had worked in doll factories, dressing dolls, and yeah, different things like that. So we both
here in New York.
So, right, yeah. So.
Because I remember you had a sewing club of some sort, didn't you?
Well, I had that in Freeport. I had started that in Freeport, and I'd helped teach people how to sew. You know, I taught Nell really a lot of how to sew. We made slipcovers for her house, and we made slipcovers at my house. But, you know, I helped her do a lot of that and taught her how. And I can't remember what year we went in. Marie and I went in.
Wasn't there something on Allen Drive, though, too, like a sewing circle or something people would come around?
Oh, they still came. Oh, they still came. The ones from Freeport as well.
Oh, they would drive together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But others joined us in Allen Drive.
Was it like once a week? Or?
Yeah, once a week. And if people wanted to bring the mending, sew buttons on, whatever. You know, it was a gossip session. It was a chance to get out. And we helped each other with what we were doing. Made drapes for houses, for our houses and all that. And then it was a few years later, I don't remember what year it was, that Marie and I decided to go into, because I was doing, making dresses for people. I had done it for nothing, you know, for a long time, and then people wanted me to pay me for it. So I did it for quite a few friends in Merrick that I knew there. And then it just sort of evolved, and then Marie and I decided to go into to together. And what we did first is we did aprons. we made aprons and then toaster covers and oven mitts and all these things to match. And people would come to what we would have an apron party. People would come and order what they would like and how they'd like it made. And we did that, and then we got into making more and more clothes. And I designed it, you know, clothes for people. And Maria and I both. So she was a wonderful seamstress, too. And when George was born, was when I quit. And that was my sixth, and I just think it was just too much because I was having to hire somebody to help take care of the kids. And Maria and Al insisted that they should pay for half of that. Because we were doing it together. We were working together, and I had all the kids, and she had two. And then another reason, too, and then I had, as I said, when I had George, I said, this is it. It's just too much.
So and Maria and Al, you did it?
Oh, I don't really remember. Maybe Maria.
So Al was very supportive.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so was your father. I mean, they thought that was great. So a lot of our friends were, too. But we also found some of the people, no matter how little you gave it to them for, it was too much.
But they don't decide that after they already taken it, then they didn't want to pay.
You mean it's that much? So I learned to say they'd come with a bunch of material, you know, that they wanted made into a suit or they wanted made, you know, into a skirt and all this, and I'd say, take it to the tailor and see how much he charges you to do it. But lots of times, a lot of things we did was just take up hems on skirts and, mm-hmm. you know, things like that, repair work, a lot of that. But it was very nice.
So you tried to, if it was something new, you tried to give them a sense first of what it would cost.
We learned that. We didn't learn that. Accidentally, we just found out, you know, they said, oh, you know, how much she charged me for this? And it would be like hours and hours of work. And they just...
They didn't count that?
No. So it can get pretty hairy, too, when you have to have something finished at a certain time and you're up half the night with the kids and you're trying to finish a suit. And I remember especially one plaid suit. With a pleated skirt and the pockets and everything on it. And we charged her $20 to make it. And the tailors would have charged her, even in those times, you know, $50 to $60 at least. And she said, she came back and she said to us, my husband thinks it was too much, just too expensive.
Who was that?
Mary, remember? Mary and John?
Oh, yeah.
So was she going to bring it back, or?
No.
He decided no. He didn't need that business anymore,
no.
though?
No. Well, she was a good friend, you know, so you just sort of...
But, well, I'm sorry. You told her how much, any hours it took to make it.
So when I quit, then Marie started, did quite a bit on her own, but then she started working with Nick, who... we bought the freezer from.
Was it that common then for women to have businesses?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Small businesses?
Oh, yes. There was always, dressmakers and people that did that. But it was always common for women to have small businesses. Even when I was a kid on the farm, you know, women went and sold the cream, they sold the eggs. A lot of farms kept working on the egg money that the women made. And they just sort of forgot that, you know. And it was the same during the war. How many women were working during the war? And after the husbands came home, they stopped the working. But as far back as I remember, it's the same. They made it sound as if women, you know, started working up in the 50s or the 60s, and it's not so. I mean, there were women school teachers as far back as I can remember.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But during the war, it changed the type of fields they could get in.
Oh, yeah.
Like, education was always seen as, like, normal schools for women.
Right.
And dressmaking maybe was seen as women could do that. but didn't...
Yeah, at one time, all the big designers were women. Now, who are all the big designers? Are men.
Mm-hmm. All and I think they... were women when I was growing up.
There was very few women, men teachers.
There were men teachers in my school.
Men teachers,
yeah.
But the women were in the majority, especially
in the lower
grammar school.
In the lower grades.
In high school, you had a mix, male and female.
Well, even in high school in Edmonton, I had a mix. I had several male teachers for different subjects. But it amazes me now, some of the things I read and see, and I said, you know, look back before you write these things. Look back in history, and you can see.
Well, what type of work could women get that was different during the war that they couldn't before?
In the factories.
Mostly the factories.
Right, right.
In the munition factories.
In the munition factories. Now, my cousin Shirley worked in Boeing all those years, making the planes.
And did other industries that used to hire men only because the men were going away also open up to women?
Oh, yeah. In the offices even. Now, when I worked for Look magazine, the office manager there was a woman. She was like head of the payroll department, and I was her assistant. She got the job because the man who had the job went into the service. And then she got the job. And a lot of these women that had these jobs, they gave them up when their husbands came home and their boyfriends. Because the men needed jobs badly then. Mm-hmm. And the women were needed to raise the children again, you know.
I think it was a fairly common experience of many people. It just changed because of the war, because of the emergency.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The attitude just... adjusted.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of movement during the war, too. People moving across country.
Oh, yeah.
Jobs were better here.
Yep.
There.
Yep. Well, that had even started before the war because of the Depression. Mm-hmm. People, whole families were packing up and leaving all over.
Sure, the Okies picked up and left for California.
I mean, the rest of the country... I mean, California was very uninhabited for a long time until the big storms in the dust storms and everything in Kansas. And
they used to call it the Dirty 30s.
Yeah.
The Dirty 30s because of the dust storms.
The world really changed tremendously with the Second World War. And it was a terrible war, but it also changed the whole economy.
When the people came back from the war, was there initial fear of how they would be reintegrated? You know, all these men coming back at one time?
I don't remember that. Do you?
Well,
there were so many jobs to be...
concerned, but you had the GI Bill, whereby I forget what the fee was, but they were given a certain amount of money for 52 weeks. I think it was $20 a week, 52, 20 and out. And $20 was a lot of money in those days. Then a lot of the guys went on to college, which they wouldn't have been able to do. They went under the GI Bill.
Was that the same bill covered both?
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's the same bill or not, but the GI Bill was there. And they went on to college. And then the economy started picking up because there had been no action at all for years before the war, and during the war, you had a shortage.
During the war, all of industry and the manufacturing were towards war. The uniforms, the ammunition, the guns, the planes, the cars, everything like that were all done. When that ended, then the economy continued good because now people needed cars at home. You know, everything had to change over, but the manufacturers would just change what they were manufacturing to peacetime.
Was there incentive the government was giving the manufacturers to change what they were producing to?
I don't think it was a necessity.
I don't think so.
No.
I think it was just a natural growth, you know. You come in with plastics. You didn't have any plastics before. TV, all of a sudden, come in with about, 47, thereabouts. We had no TV before when we were kids.
Well, maybe they were paid to transfer two armaments.
You had.
And then the reconversion wasn't as difficult to go back.
Well, there was, don't forget, there was also experiments going on mm-hmm. everything during the war, on every different kind of thing.
So they could use that experience.
Right, right.
And now there was consumer demand.
Right.
Because if all these guys were making $20 a week, they wanted to spend it.
That's right. And not only that, but you had no cars during the war, being produced by the during the war, you know. No radios, nothing.
Because the cars were all being like military jeeps.
Sure. Right. You couldn't get any tires.
And, couldn't use gas.
And all of a sudden, the war is over. You want all these things. And that was it.
And same with food was rationed and all those things all during the war.
Did it seem like when you were going to move from Freeport to Seaford, did it seem like things were really opening up, that you know, were going to get your own place and out on Long Island? Or, I mean, was that a common experience after the war? People would get a job, and then it looked like it was growing, and people were feeling secure.
Well, there's also the G.I. Bill, mm-hmm. where you could take a loan out when you were buying a home. You could get the G.I. Bill, gave money to people when they bought their own homes. So it became as cheap to buy a home as it was to rent.
I see.
So,
that's right, Levittown was built.
You've probably heard the story of Levittown. I mean, there it tells it all, what went on all over the country, and even in Canada, the same.
So because they had that money, they saw if they would take out a mortgage and put their, whatever, $15 a week into a mortgage, or less,
right.
It was the same as what they were paying for rent.
For rent, right. So, and the big dream is you want to own your own home. Yeah, interesting times.
Yeah.
But you know, you just live through those times and you don't find them too unusual because it's gradual. It doesn't happen all at one time.
And it's happening to everyone else around you.
Exactly, exactly. And the jobs were really pretty plentiful right after the war.
Must have been, especially compared to everybody's experience before the war.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think about just going to college. I mean, yeah, it was tough for you kids to go to college, but not nearly as tough as it was for your father's generation to go to college. It meant nothing to a lot of the people whom we knew that became lawyers and everything to have two jobs and go to college full time. I mean, they look at Bob Hume.
Yeah.
And they didn't think anything of it. And I think about the kids that go to college today who take out these big, big loans, and they wouldn't push themselves to that point. Some did it then if they wanted to go on to college, and the majority didn't go to college that do today.
Well, maybe the next time we back up, we'll back up. I think we talked about my birth and up to Tim's, maybe.
I don't know.
Well, I'll look and see.
We skipped over a few things and jumped from one thing
to another.
So
maybe we'll talk about the others. I spoke to Dad about, we could probably look at the your diary entries around that time.
And see what his comments were, too.
Yeah, it would be, it'd probably be interesting juxtaposition. Because
I wouldn't make any comments and make mostly family affairs, you know.
Oh, that's what we're talking about. Oh. Around the time of the birth of the...
Of each one of the children.
Each of the different children.
My impression and your impression.
And not only your impression, but what from your diary else was going on.
Right.
Either in the family or whatever, if you don't mind. That would possibly be interesting.
How much of this do you have to have for your course?
I think there's enough for today.